Hello and welcome to Cage Club. Two movie fans, 72 movies, one cage. That's Mike Manzi, I'm Joey Lewandowski, and we just watched Racing with the Moon.
This is our fifth episode.
Fifth episode.
So, what did you think?
I really like this movie. Came out in 1984, so it's a new year for Cage. Plays a character named Nikki, so, you know.
Not a stretch.
Not a stretch. It's the second time in the five movies that he's basically been named his actual name. What I also did like is that later in the movie, he goes by an alias, and he's Bud, and in Fast Times, he was Brad's Bud,
yes,
so he's sort of Bud in that, too.
Picked
so,
up that connection. More Cage
connections. The name, I mean, his names are all sort of, like, in that same sort of wheelhouse. This movie, Cage isn't the star of this movie. There's, again, sort of like Rumblefish. He's not in it for pretty long stretches, but he is third billed, and he is in it a whole lot. Whenever he's on screen, we were talking about it before we started recording, almost all of his lines are just amazing. And so it's sort of hard to pick the ones that we want to include in this episode because he's really just sort of... He's almost a comic relief a little bit because this movie does get heavy at times. He's a comic relief and he's also just sort of the wacky friend who ultimately teaches Sean Penn how to be a better person, live a better life, whatever. Basically so he doesn't wind up like Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, they are playing off each other really well in this movie, like, very naturally, like they're best friends, almost in real life, too. I was very surprised by the chemistry with everybody in this movie. I enjoyed it very much as well. I almost got an Amblin Entertainment-type feel with, you know, this Spielbergian-esque feel to this movie.
Definitely. So this reunites Nicolas Cage with Sean Penn from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It briefly reunites him with Crispin Glover from The Best of Times.
From Best of Times, way back in episode one.
Way back in episode one. And it pairs him with Elizabeth McGovern, who he'll later see on screen. I don't even know if... I don't think he interacts with her at all in Kick-Ass.
Yeah, I wasn't even aware that she was in Kick-Ass until you mentioned it.
Yeah, I had to look her up, and she's just basically... She's Kick-Ass's mom. So, like, that's... I think she's only in a couple scenes. It's not like she has a huge part in that movie, but it just sort of... There's not that many characters in this movie... And sort of, you know, the top three billed people, or the top two billed people, in addition to Cage, he's worked with in other things. So it's just sort of coincidental and cool and whatever.
Yeah, and this feels more like a fleshed-out character for him this time, you know, with an arc, you know, a full-on supporting character.
So the one thing, I guess the first thing to sort of talk about is that Sean Penn is the lead. He plays a guy, and I've already forgotten his name, and we just talked about it, and I literally just watched the movie.
His name is Henry Nash.
Henry Nash, and they call him Hopper, but they almost never, as opposed to Rusty James in Rumblefish, who they say his name every 45 seconds, they almost never say Hopper's name. They never say Henry Nash. He calls him, Nick Cage calls him Hopper, and it's just sort of, I guess it's just, you know, style of writer or whatever. It's just weird how some movies, you can watch an entire movie and just not necessarily know the character's name.
Yeah, I actually like the way several details are revealed in this movie. The plot is really well structured, and the only thing you get right off the bat is a title card that says 1942, December, California. After that, that's basically all you get, and then throughout the movie, all these details about the characters are revealed until the end when a full picture of everybody is sort of complete for you to look at.
Yeah, so it stars Sean Penn, as we were saying, and it's sort of, it's almost as far from Spicoli as it could possibly be, I would say.
Yeah, he still has a little naivete to him, sort of, I would say.
Yeah, he's cultured, he plays the piano.
Yes.
He's headed off to war. I mean, everybody, there really couldn't be a Spicoli in 1942.
Probably not.
And I think that's something worth talking about, whether we want to do it now or later, is just how different the world was in 1942. The world of this movie, the world in which they have, everybody is basically going to school. Like, I can't imagine how difficult it would be to concentrate when you're just like in high school, in December and January, knowing that in mid-February you're getting shipped off to Europe.
Yeah, and we get to see in this movie two different ways of dealing with that pressure and that anticipation, right? We see Sean Penn, who sort of just is ignoring it the entire movie. And then we see Nick Cage, who sort of can't stop talking about it, you know, constantly going on about new weapons the Nazis have, you know, all the Japanese people he's going to slaughter. So you really do get that. You get both points of view, or you get at least two points of view of what these kids, the way they handle the situation.
And I think they share a commonality in that they're both scared to go to war. and they're just sort of handling it differently.
Yeah, they seem to be trying to own up to being a man, whatever that means at that time, but
right. They
don't want to expose their emotions about what they're scared of. I mean, eventually they will open up to each other somewhat, but you know, when it comes to the war, it just, I don't know, it's a different level.
So the movie is, it's a heavy movie, but it is also a comedy. There is a lot of funny stuff in it.
It's lighthearted. It's got some whimsy, right?
There are some things, like one of the first lines of the movie is Sean Penn's leaving his house, and his dad comes in, and he says, "Hey, Argus." And Sean Penn says, "No, Dad, Argus is the dog. I'm Henry." Which, like, just does, like, it's such a weird, like, line to include in the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, you sort of think, is this going to be, like, that kind of movie? And it's not really. It is sort of, you know, like you were saying, it's lighthearted, but that's just sort of a very strange, in terms of tone, a joke to sort of kick the movie off with.
Yeah, I agree. The dad character isn't exactly comic relief either. He doesn't come back and try and make his son laugh or the audience later on. He's actually
right. A
very serious character later on, you know, that gives pretty good advice to his son.
It's very interesting.
But the movie's like that in the way that, you know, at first it has nothing to do with the war. You have no idea that he's off the war until, like, the third scene. He's, right, he gets up and he's walking along the tracks and
yeah. Doesn't
he walk his dog and then he goes to work and then you find out that, like, oh, they're going to be shipped off in a little while.
Yeah, I mean, really sort of without, like, I think this movie could be told in any era instead of going to war, you could sort of, you know, plug in any kind of thing that people are fearing because these actors of that age, they're all sort of coming of age in one way or another. And the big fear at this time in the 40s was going to war. You don't necessarily, like you were saying, like you start the movie off not knowing exactly where we are until you get the title card that we're in 1942. And you don't really know what the driving conflict is going to be until they start to talk about it. It can just sort of be a slice of life about whenever it's happening.
Yeah, it almost has that American Graffiti feel to it, where it's just, you know, there's story, there's underlying events and things, but mostly it's a bunch of kids hanging out. And, like, again, that's sort of what we have here. They're just killing 6 weeks before they're shipped off, and we get to see, you know, Sean Penn's starts a budding romance, and Nick Cage sort of gets in trouble with his romance. And,
exactly.
You know, we see what the quest for getting laid results in for them with, you know, different consequences for both.
Exactly. So I think what we can do, I mean, there's sort of, there isn't necessarily, like, there are through lines for characters, but there's not, like, a sequence of events. Like you're saying, it's just two guys sort of killing 6 weeks before they get shipped off to war. It's not like Rumblefish in that it's sort of, you know, dreamlike and kind of, in a weird way, hard to follow, but it doesn't necessarily follow, like, Valley Girl is, you know, they start their relationship, they break up, they get back together happily ever after. But I think we can, like it, like when we did for that movie, we can go through it beat by beat and talk about what happens and how great Nicolas Cage is pretty much from start to finish in this movie.
Yeah. Agreed.
I guess we could start, because we sort of introed the movie, but we can start with when we first meet Nick Cage, and he is working as a bowling pin resetter at a bowling alley, and just drinking hard liquor while resetting these pins.
Yeah, I love this introduction of his character, because it's almost as if he's being shelled by fire, you know, like he's already in the trenches. And, you know, the people bowling and him having to reset the pins, it's almost like he's being fired upon and being shelled upon the beach or something.
But he's being shelled upon by George McFly himself, Crispin Glover. And I feel like, and this is never really explicitly said, and it might not necessarily be true, I don't know if the Gatsbys, as they call the rich kids in this movie, if the Gatsbys are going to get shipped off to war too. It seems like they're living a much more carefree lifestyle. They have the money. They don't need to work for a living. They don't need to work to get by. And they're not plagued with this weight of getting shipped off to war.
Yeah, I almost expected Crispin Glover's character to say something like, you know, you're going to war and you're going to, my daddy's making the weapons or something. I get to go to college and, like,
exactly.
I'll be making the weapons while you be shooting them.
And they do. They do later in the movie, I think, Caddy, who's Elizabeth McGovern's character, says to Hopper something along the lines of, you know, you could still be going to school. Like, basically, you don't have to go to war. You could go to school instead. And he says, well, I have to go over there one way or another, so I might as well get it over with. He just sort of resigned to his inevitability that, you know, he might not necessarily be able to afford school and he knows he's going to have to get over there anyway, so why delay the inevitable? Whereas a Crispin Glover character, a Gatsby, and he's literally just credited as Gatsby Boy, can have his daddy pay for 4 years of college, and by that point, it'll be 1946, World War II will be over, and there'll still be, you know, places for him to get shipped off to, if he even gets over there, but the worst of it will be behind them.
Yeah, Crispin Glover is very weaselly, and I don't like his character at all. He is throwing a bowling ball at his one-time best friend from another movie, and just, I am so happy when Sean Penn decks him in the face.
Yeah, and there's so much blood from that one punch.
And the blood gets on Crispin's date or girlfriend.
Yeah, and Nick Cage goes to clean it up and just basically pops a feel while he's like he sort of like wipes off the blood and is doing nothing, and then like as he's walking away, he just reaches out and grabs the girl's boob and then just
he just tunes in Tokyo. It's crazy.
It's the best. I mean, it's just like nobody comments on it. He just does it and just walks away. And the girl seems like okay with it, which is sort of weird, but hey, it's a character trait, and clearly Nick Cage is a better person than Gatsby Boy, Crispin Glover. The next thing, like, what I like about this movie are these little bits of characterization, as we were sort of talking about. And, you know, while they're talking just sort of about life, they're outside just filling up vodka bottles with water. And I'm not sure if they're running, like, a scam. Did they ever explain what they were doing with that?
The only thing I could sort of extrapolate is that they're watering down the liquor to save money because maybe they serve to underage kids or just to save a buck. But, yeah, they were definitely filling vodka bottles up with, like, a little bit of vodka and then, like, a lot of bit of water.
They're hustlers, and that sort of comes back later in what, I mean, we'll get to it, but it's probably my favorite scene in any of these five movies that we've watched is them playing pool. I love that scene so much.
Yeah, that is a terrific scene.
Again, well, I mean, we'll talk about it later, but that's two movies in a row where Nick Cage is a pool hustler.
Another Cage connection.
So as I was watching this, you know, because Nick Cage is in the first, he's sort of in the first 10 or 15 minutes, then it just sort of follows Sean Penn as he's sort of courting Elizabeth McGovern. And I was thinking that what we could do is come up with like an alternate timeline or like a behind-the-scenes movie, or I'm not sure exactly the best way to describe it, but like talk about what Nick Cage's character is doing in all these movies while he's not on screen.
Okay, yeah, I understand.
Because you were saying for the last one, you sort of wanted a prequel or a sequel where Cage is disbanding the gang and sort of moving on and taking over. Here, I mean, you sort of get a sense of what he's doing. He's probably just up to more wacky antics when he's not on screen. I guess having unprotected sex with his girlfriend. But I think it'd be sort of, you know, if there are any things that we can guess as to what he's doing when he's off camera, I think that'd be could be kind of cool.
Well, the one situation that he does get himself into is he gets his girlfriend pregnant, and they need $150 for an abortion.
Which seems like a lot of money compared to what other things cost back then.
Yeah, it does. Even for 1942, it seems a little expensive. I was even a little shocked that she could get, that was an option, that she could get an abortion.
That's true.
They take her to like a trailer in the woods from a horror movie. I was sort of taken aback. Second Cage movie where abortion takes place.
It's
an 80s issue as well as a modern issue.
It is. It's weird. I'm not sure if it's more weird or just sort of something that we should come to accept, that there are so many Cage connections between all these movies. I mean, I think that's really what you get, like the real benefit you get by watching all these movies in order. You really see the evolution of fears and trends and sort of, you know, not just in terms of like storytelling, but also in terms of filmography and the way you make movies and everything like that. And I think it's sort of cool that like there's so much in common with these first five movies that we've watched, even though all five are pretty different in different ways.
Yeah, it's definitely cool, and it makes me wonder if his influence had anything to do with it. You know, if he picked a project based on his personal tastes or likes, or if while he was on that project, you know, he somehow influenced the direction of certain scenes or certain, you know, ideas, you know, and was able to sort of add his originality, you know, his cageness, if you will, in areas where maybe the director or writer, you know, wasn't sure, and, you know, they gave it a shot, and it ended up working. I like to believe that.
Yeah, I like to believe that, too. That sounds... Let's go with that.
Okay.
one note I have here, we like to talk about Cage's hair in all the movies. His hair is pretty scaled back in this movie. He almost looks like a young Sailor Ripley from Wild at Heart. You know, he wears the wife beater a lot. He's got the slick back hair.
Much more of a greaser look, even though he's sort of ahead of the times. In the last movie, I got a much more of an Elvis vibe from him. And in this one, he kind of looks like the guy that might beat Elvis up. I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but he just, the slick back shorts, almost Cruise style, gives him more menace, I thought. I don't know.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But while his hair is sort of toned down and slicked back, his chest hair, as we talked about, you know, when it was shaved into like an S shape in a previous movie, it's sort of out of control. And I think that's partially because he's wearing the wife beater, but he's got this
it's unkempt. Cage is sort of unkempt.
Yeah, it's unkempt. Cage is sort of known for crazy hair. His hair is toned down, but his chest hair is turned up to 11.
I wonder if he got that, if his dad gave him that black eye because that unruly chest hair of his. he just told him to shave it and shave him one day. He just hit him with the razor right in the eye. I don't know. But almost getting back to, you know, what was his character doing while Sean Penn was off romancing?
Right.
Do you have any, I mean, it was really interesting when they revealed their scheme, but do you think he tried to get that $150 any other way, or was he sort of just waiting for Sean Penn's help, or do you think he, you know, maybe he was staking out the local candy shop or something and he was going to rob an old lady? I'm not sure, but things started flashing in my head. You know, where was he? What was he doing?
I mean, I would like to imagine an alternate reality that's like with the montage set to Yakety Sax, where he's trying to, you know, come up with all these different ways to make money, and everything's failing miserably. In reality, I think the more plausible, in terms of like who the characters are, I really feel like he wouldn't be able to come up with any like reasonable way of getting the money without Sean Penn's help.
Yeah, he's almost the Rusty James in this one, where he's not cunning or can't come up with the plan, necessarily.
Yeah.
Always looking for sort of an easy answer.
So Sean Penn falls in love with this girl that he just sort of sees around. And he goes to the movies and he walks out the movies and he sees that she is at the ticket counter. And so he leaves a flower and walks away. And then he goes to the pie shop across the street. I guess it must be a small town because it's not like coincidence that he's hanging out there. It just seems like it's their normal hangout, right?
Yeah, I think it's just the diner and they were hanging out there after hours because they're trying to spend as much time together before they ship off.
And so it seems like the movie theater is across the street, and Elizabeth McGovern, after her shift, comes across for a piece of pie, and Sean Penn jumps behind the counter and takes the diner operator's hat, he's just passed out at the counter, which is strange.
Well, he was old. He was very old, so, you know, he probably just got tired, and, you know, these kids are there every night, so they're not going to do anything crazy, especially not Sean Penn. Nothing crazy like give an entire pie away.
I call that the Sean Penn pie plan. So Elizabeth McGovern comes in to ask for a piece of pie and wrap it up to go, and he just takes a whole pie and just wraps it up, and she says, "Oh, I only want a piece." And he says, "Oh, don't worry, it's on special." And she's like, "Okay, thanks, bye." And she just leaves.
Then he picks up like a meat cleaver to cut a piece of pie, and he like looks at it as if it's like a circle peg in a square hole, and is just like, "Does not compute."
Does not compute.
Panics and just gives the whole pie away. And Nick Cage is just so, like, got this look on his face, like, "Dude, you are the smoothest."
Yeah, Nick. Like, so she sits down on the counter, and then Nick Cage just comes over and sits down next to her, like, doesn't even, like, interject. He's just like, "I want a front row seat to, like, how embarrassing this is going to be."
Exactly. I love that move.
It's real good. So then Elizabeth McGovern, a little bit later, is with her friend at the diner, and Sean Penn walks in, and she calls him over and says, "Hey, do you want to go out?" And he thinks she's asking him out on a date. He's like, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." And then she's like, "Okay, great. You can go out with my friend." And so they go on a double date. And they go to the roller rink.
Yeah, I think it's a USO hall, and they're having a roller skating event.
I think so. I'm not exactly sure, but it's on Christmas Eve.
Yes.
Which I don't think is necessarily worth pointing out, but I just love movies. I love movies that are set at Christmas that aren't really about Christmas.
Yeah, it's got what I've become to call like the Shane Black Christmasness to a movie, where it's there, but it doesn't really serve any direct purpose to the story. It just sort of takes place at Christmas time.
Yeah, and so he's sort of in a... Sean Penn is sort of in like a kind of a Valley Girl situation, or what he thinks is a Valley Girl situation. You know, he's from the other side of the tracks as Elizabeth McGovern, because he follows her home one night after he gives her the pie, like a real creeper, and sees her walk into this gigantic, gigantic house.
Yeah, it's like the biggest house in town. And Nick Cage follows him following her.
Yeah, and he like shows up like immediately afterwards. So, like, I don't know, he didn't have to like skitch a ride on the bus. He could have just, you know, popped in the car and just followed along. But
yeah, he could have just been like, Nikki, get me there. Like, follow that girl. Like, he would have gotten there faster.
But so we find out a little bit later in the movie that she's not actually rich. She's not actually a Gatsby. Her mom is the housekeeper for the rich people, and so she just lives at the house.
And that's a great reveal, too. She goes home one day after Christmas and opens a gift, and she says something to the maid, like, oh, Mom. And I was like, Mom? Oh, she's not the daughter of the owner of the house? Like, her mother's the maid, and she lives there, too. And that is information we have that Sean Penn will not have for a very long time.
And that's sort of something that, you know, her character holds a grudge against Sean Penn's character, because she thinks he's only after her because she's rich, but he really sort of doesn't care about that.
Yeah, it's not important to him whatsoever. It was never important to him, really. The only reason it mattered to him is he didn't think he'd be good enough for her.
And so they sort of start out this relationship on kind of tenuous ground, and things aren't necessarily, you know, it's not going great, but it's sort of like weird to me that it takes him so long to bust out his amazing piano playing skills. Like, you would think that, you know, somebody that good at piano, if they're trying to win over a girl, they would bust that out, like, as soon as they possibly can. But it seems like it takes a while for him to get there.
Yeah, you would think he'd have orchestrated some kind of plan to get her in front of a piano and hearing him play. Instead, you know, he's sort of just, luckily, she sort of sees the charm in him when they're at the USO show. Like, he's almost a klutz, and she sees the way he handles being made fun of and just brushes it off and gives him a chance, and they hang out. He takes her to an abandoned theater, I think. I'm not exactly sure. But there's a piano there, and he straight up seduces her with those magic fingers.
What I thought was sort of interesting, and I was trying to... I noticed this about halfway through the piano shots, and I tried to follow along. I don't think Sean Penn can actually play the piano, because they never show him actually playing. It's always shots of hands, and then they cut up, and it's just without his hand.
Yeah, I agree with you. I believe they're just a hand double.
Yeah, it looks like they're like at like an abandoned theater, like that just overlooks the water. Like, I don't understand what this building is.
Yeah, it looked as if it was burnt at one point, or maybe it was built too close to the shore, so it, like, in a storm, it got destroyed. But there's this like perfectly tuned piano there
that nobody's taken away, nobody's vandalized. It's just sort of hanging out, waiting to be played, and that's sort of where he wins her heart.
And it sort of turns out to be a make-out point of a sorts, too, as they end up making out there.
But not as much of a make-out point as in the middle of that lake,
right?
Which is kind of adorable. He, like, leads her on a scavenger hunt to find this lake. That was it his dad, or was it Nick Cage's dad? It was his dad.
Yeah.
Sort of hid a watch for the boys and, like, left them a treasure map to go find it. And they went and they hunted down the watch, and so it's like the secret place that only belongs to them, and he brings her there, and things get pretty hot and heavy.
Yeah, in the middle of winter.
But, like, it's January in California, and it seems like it looks really nice outside.
Yeah, and I just assume that it's always warm in California. It never gets below 60.
I think, yeah, but even, like, if it's 60 degrees, I guess the water's not warm at all. Like, it's just...
Yeah, and again, it's
uncomfortably cold.
Cold in relation to someone who's lived in California their entire life, as this, I assume the character has. They would know, I guess, the difference in air temperature better than me.
But she doesn't care, and she goes in, and they start making out, and that's sort of the real, like, a real sort of turning point in their relationship. That's where they sort of, I guess that's sort of where they become really sort of serious.
Yeah, I believe they're both in love with each other at this point, and she's stopped. Well, aside from telling him she's not really lying. See, it's kind of tough. Like, they both get to be themselves at this point, you know? But she's still harboring a secret. Yeah, it's not entirely damaging at this point, you know, if it were to come out. It's not until later when they start relying on the status that she imagines she's rich, and they need to use that, then it becomes sort of a problem.
Right. And like we were saying before, like, Sean Penn doesn't care whether she's rich or poor. He's just in love with her. It seems like Nick Cage is the one who really is obsessed with her being rich because she'll be able to help him when he's in a bind.
Yeah, if their plan to get the $150, you know, doesn't work, then Nick Cage is like, okay, she's our plan B.
So about halfway through the movie, it cuts to Nick Cage and Sean Penn just hanging out on a rooftop drinking. The next 5 minutes are pretty much just drunk Cage being amazing.
Yeah, they start out on top of the bowling alley, and it seems like it's dusk, and then the next scene they are wrecked walking in some alleyway at nighttime, and they are hammered. It's, you know, it's awesome. And Cage is talking, all right, I caught this, that Nick Cage is talking about this submarine movie starring Tyrone Power and how, like, he's a total badass when the sub is flooding and everyone's on fire.
So, they're in the submarine, right? And the Japs are going at them with everything they got. Guys are drowning. Guys are on fire. There are sharks and they got guns. So you know what Tyrone Power says? He says, fuck them! Just like that.
Tyrone Power never said fuck them.
Right. And that's what he does. He just serves the meal at Tokyo Harbor. Jeez. What balls. Maybe we should join the submarine corps.
So I looked up the movie and I think he's talking about Crash Dive, which is a Tyrone Power film, but it didn't come out until 1943. I guess this is... are we in 1943? Is this the week between Christmas and New Year's? Because they never celebrate New Year's, so I don't know when we're switching years. But he must have just seen that movie. He was first in line. And I love that about his character. And then they spot a tattoo parlor.
Well, before they do that, there's one little moment...
Oh, it's a great moment. Oh, yes. Back it up.
Where Sean Penn is like... Hey, man, you gotta stop drinking. You're drunk.
You wouldn't know a pussy if you saw one.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You know why? You know why? Because you drink too much.
Me?
Pisses me off. Pisses me off badly. Because when you drink too much, it makes your brain soft.
Let me show you something. Before I started drinking, I could not do that.
Why would you want to do that?
It gives me pleasure. Wowie!
Wowie!
And Nick Cage is like, yeah, but like, I couldn't do this if I wasn't drunk. He does like this little weird little dance move.
Yeah, it's almost like a marionette shimmy where he like has his like arms up and he's moving his body all weird.
I love it.
It's terrific. And then they see the tattoo parlor and they both say, wowie. And it is like, I fell on the floor because they're like, wowie. And they're not like, they're doing it because kids then their age would use that term. Like, right. That's what came to mind. I was like, they're selling it. They just, you know, especially Nick, where he turned and he's like, wowie, a tattoo parlor.
And they walk in and Drunk Cage, I'm not sure if this is true for Sober Cage, but Drunk Cage has an obsession with eagles. He has this vision of him getting a huge eagle tattoo on his chest. And then I guess over in war, just being like, just no shirt on, no jacket, no armor, just like running over a hill and just shooting whatever enemies happen to see him.
Right here. Clear across my goddamn chest.
A real patriot, huh?
Damn right. In just 4 short weeks, me and my buddy here are going to be proud members of the United States Marine Corps.
Lucky us. Listen, kid, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm not going to put anything on your chest. That way, when you wake up in the morning, you still have that wonderful baby pink skin. You thank me, believe me.
Hey, wait a minute. This is the bird of freedom we're talking about here. Ain't no American that wouldn't be proud to carry that over his heart.
You ought to cut down on the newsreels, kid.
Hey, what is this? You give tattoos or advice?
All right. How much have you boys got?
I got $1.25.
I got 13 cents.
$1.38 will get you a sparrow on your elbow.
A sparrow?
Well, how about a snake coming out of your navel? Now, that's real popular.
You've got to be kidding. He's kidding, right, Hop? I'm talking about the high-flying red, white, and blue bird of freedom here.
The bird of freedom don't come cheap.
So the other thing I noticed in the tattoo parlor is that Nick Cage is ripped. Like, he pulls his shirt up to show the guy where he wants a tattoo, and he's got, like, an 8-pack of abs.
And he keeps his shirt up with the abs revealed for the entire sequence.
Yeah.
As soon as the shirt goes up, it does not go down until they cut.
And Sean Penn just standing there just sort of giggling the whole time.
And the tattoo artist, like, looks at Cage, and he's like, man, you are piss-faced drunk. I ain't giving you no tattoo. Like, I'm going to give you some advice instead. Get out of here and go sober up, because, yeah, I'm saving you from a horrible decision. After they leave the tattoo shop, they end up on the train tracks, just sort of stumbling along, hanging out drunk, remembering the good times.
And I think it's sort of like the movie starts with Sean Penn walking on the train tracks, and he sees two little boys, and like you don't realize until this scene that those little boys are sort of him and Nick Cage 8 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was nice. I put that together around the same time.
It's a nice little touch that these two little boys who are still living sort of in an innocent world, they're not a month away from getting shipped off to somewhere in Germany or Europe or Japan or whatever. They don't have the worries that these two characters have.
Now, what happens next sort of made me wonder if these two are some kind of thrill junkies, and that's why they're going to war for the sort of extreme action and sense of feeling alive, because they straight up train dodge. It's a really strong sequence, I thought, really well shot, and they do what they call racing the train.
Right.
Which is basically, you know, wait for the train to get as close to you as possible, dodge it, and then if you survive that, run as fast as you can and hold on to the train and ride on the side of it for as long as you can hold on.
And I guess that's sort of where the name of the movie comes from, but I don't know, and maybe I'm missing something obvious, I don't know where the moon part comes from the title. Do you?
No, I was curious if it was named after a song title or something, you know, if that was the inspiration. But
sure.
Ultimately, I just sort of supplemented the moon to mean the night, and then ultimately the night to mean, like, their freedom. So they're sort of racing with their freedom, you know, before they have to go to war. They're getting, you know, they're trying to live the most they can before they have to fight.
I guess racing with the night would also make sense, but that would sort of be like a darker movie than this one.
Yeah, that might come later in Cage's career. I could see that being the name of something that he stars in.
The next scene is one of the funniest scenes, I think, in the movie. But it also sort of shows just how much of a different time the 1940s are from today. They're at school, and I guess it's like a class or something, and they're all basically just doing military training. People dead in the field, and nurses going around, and, you know, medics going around, trying to attend to injured and dead bodies.
Yeah, it appeared to me like some sort of air raid drill. Like, they are on the coast on California, you know, so they are in distance of Japan at the time, you know. They're not, you know, they are in danger of being attacked. So it seemed to be some kind of drill, as if the school was attacked and students are strewn about the entire front of the school.
But there's like people like laying all over the ground, just covered in fake blood. One guy's got a sign that just says "shot all over," like just like pinned to his chest, basically like, "Don't worry about me, I'm way gone." And he's just laying there, sort of smiling and laughing. Like, there's like a sense of innocence here that you're in the middle of the biggest war in history, really, and to a lot of these kids, it just doesn't click. It doesn't make sense to them.
It also sort of reminded me of Duck and Cover, and later on how much of a joke that became because you just aren't protected whatsoever. So they're almost making light of the situation of like, hey, if we're attacked, like, we're going to die. And, you know, there's no surviving an attack. Like,
right.
Who are we kidding? Like, they're just sort of projecting the absurdity of the whole situation.
And Nick Cage is, you know, he steals the show again in this. He gets picked up on a stretcher, and like a nurse like walks away to go attend to someone else, and he just says to her, "Hey, come back, nurse, I want to show you my wound." And then as he's getting carried away, he's just like grabbing other nurses' butts and just, and he's just doing the same thing he was doing at the bowling alley in this essentially, you know, life or death situation.
He is a complete prankster. That's what I wrote down, prankster.
And it makes him so enjoyable to watch.
It makes him endearing for some of the other things that he does as a character, you know. Ultimately, you're not necessarily supposed to like everything about him, but it's that adds to the reality of, you know, friendship. Your friends are your friends, and you accept them for who they are. And
exactly.
There's something about Cage, and at moments you hate him, you know, his character, and at other moments you just love his character. So it's, you know, you would take the good with the bad. I would be this character's friend. I would try to be, if he would let me be.
And I don't think, like, he's necessarily a bad guy. Like, he gets into a little bit of a bad situation, and he doesn't handle it well. But I don't think that necessarily makes him a bad guy. I mean, Sean Penn has problems with that, and we'll get to that in a little bit. He's not necessarily a bad guy. He just isn't equipped. Like, he just isn't equipped to be an adult yet.
Yeah. But then we get to the tangerine scene.
The tangerine scene. They're just back at the bowling alley, just sort of cleaning up, and Nick Cage is just singing along the tangerine, off-key and wonderfully.
He is in full crooner mode here. This has to... Is this around the time, I imagine, Sinatra first started out, you know, around this era, maybe? And I got that vibe from him. Like, even though his voice isn't pleasing, he has the look down.
He does have the look.
He's got that crooner look. And I hope we see more of that look next week, not to get too far ahead with the Cotton Club.
We were saying in the last episode that he would have fit perfectly into the Outsiders. I also think that Nick Cage, as the person, would have fit perfectly into the Rat Pack. The, you know, the Sinatra group, the...
Yeah, Joey Bishop, you know, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Nicolas Cage.
He's sort of like, and I think that's something that we do, that's what we love about him, is that he is kind of a chameleon in his roles, that he could take on any persona, any whatever. But I think that he could also just sort of, that makes that he could fit into any era, any group of people. He can pull it off.
He's got this timelessness to him. Like, he, you know, like, he fits into any decade, almost. You know, he can just adjust to it, adapt to any time he needs to be in. It's terrific. And something in this scene I recognized, he pretty much has his Nick Cage voice at this point that he's going to have from now on. You know, he sounds like he's going to sound for the rest of his career, which I found a little shocking, because it's a voice coming out of a face that, you know, this voice coming out of this younger face. It's just, it moved me for a minute.
Yeah, because he's only 20 in this movie. I just like so much that he's basically playing to his age. I mean, he's maybe a few years older than his character actually is. Like, he looks like he could play, you know, 30 or 35 or whatever, but he's still playing these characters, telling the stories of people that, like, his generation, his age group wants to tell and sort of are important for his age group to tell.
Yeah, that's a good call. I wonder if that has something to do with what we were talking earlier, why there's similarities between his different works so far, is because they all sort of, so far, have been about teenagers, sort of the same age, dealing with the same types of issues, and these patterns have just been emerging. And it's really cool that as an actor, I wonder if he's going to continue to do this and only play his actual age in a movie. That would be amazing.
We'll find out. I think, of the ones I've seen, I think that's pretty much true. I don't think he's ever played sort of significantly older or younger. But, I mean, we'll find out. Like, we're in the middle of it.
Like, any old Cage makeup? That would be terrific. I can't wait to find out, because I haven't seen everything, so, I mean, it could be out there.
There could be some. There probably is some real weird stuff out there we just don't know about. So the next scene is the scene we were talking about earlier. The next scene is the pool scene. And at this point in the movie, Nick Cage's girlfriend is pregnant, and she needs $150 to get an abortion. Nick Cage goes up to Sean Penn and basically says, hey, do you want to do that thing again? So it's a hustle that they've run in the past that it seems like they almost got beaten up really bad, or, you know, almost killed. They got out of there, it was successful once.
Did you think it was what it was right off the bat? I thought they were going to rob someplace, and that's, you know, he was like, we almost got killed.
I thought it might be a robbery too. I guess we could have or should have put two and two together, that they spent a lot of time playing pool. But also, when you're watching people play pool in a movie, it's a very visual thing for characters to be doing while they're talking about something else.
Yes.
So I don't think it's something that, you know, necessarily reflects poorly on us as movie watchers that we didn't pick up that they're, you know, really adept at pool. But yeah, so their hustle is sort of the oldest pool hustle in the book. It's the white men can't jump hustle.
It's page one, you know, chapter one, paragraph
and
one.
They're going to go to a bar, see people playing pool, challenge them to a game, lose a couple games, then bet big, win big, get the money, and run out of there. There's two sailors playing pool, and Nick Cage goes over to them and says, hey, do you guys want to play pool? You want to play for money? And they're sort of skeptical or whatever. And then he's like, oh, I can't play, but my friend over there can play. And, like, all of this, and they're just like, oh, yeah, like, we can do this. Are these sailors really this gullible? Like, have they never heard of a con like this before? And, you know, it's still in the, we're losing to them on purpose. And then all of a sudden, they ramp it up. They're like, all right, this game, $150.
Well, what happens is more sailors enter the bar.
Yeah.
So they have to sort of advance the plan ahead of time, I felt. You know, they're like, let's skip to the end of this hustle and, you know, break out the big guns.
And so the four sailors together have $150 between them, and they put it up. And all of a sudden, in a move that I love for this movie, when Sean Penn's about to, you know, hustle him out of $150, all of a sudden the sailor, like, it's like a double con all along. Like, he's just as good at pool as Sean Penn is, if not better. He just starts, like, running the table. Nick Cage basically goes to Sean, he's like, what's happening? He's like, this guy's a lot better at pool than he was 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, it was terrific. I don't know if you could say I kind of saw it come in, but I'd not seen this before, so I wasn't exactly sure, but it did seem like things were going a little too swimmingly. And then once they start with the swing music and the, you know, Sing 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 comes on and Louis Prima, sure. and it's on, and it's, you know, like a full on pool montage, you know, battle, you know, to the end. Like, I was like, all right, he was messing with them just as much. He knew the whole time it was just like a double con, like you said.
Sean Penn's challenge to, like, the weirdest game of pool I've ever seen. Like, I've never heard of people playing this game of pool. Maybe you have. Instead of playing 8-ball or 9-ball, both common games that I know know what the rules are, you just have to sink balls until you miss one. And it's the first one to sink 100 balls wins the money. Like, have you ever heard of this? It just seems like a weird game to be playing.
I gotta be honest, I couldn't exactly follow what game they were playing, because he goes, let's play straight pool, first to 100 wins. And then after, he says rack them up, and when the guy racks them, he writes 14 under the points column. And I'm like, how did he score 14 points if he, what is going on? Like, what is the scoring system of this game? No, I mean, they took advantage of my lack of knowledge of the game billiards.
So 8-ball is there's stripes and there's solids, and one person breaks, and then if it's me against you, and I have solids, as soon as I get all the solids in, then I can aim for the 8-ball. And if I get the 8-ball in, I win. Or vice versa for stripes. If you get all the stripes in before I get all the solids in, then you can shoot the 8-ball in, you win.
Yes.
In 9-ball, we're both going for the next ball in order.
Okay.
So you go 1 through 9, and whoever sinks the 9-ball wins.
Okay.
This game just seems to be, sink whatever ball you want, and out of the 15 balls that are on the table, you get however many points you sunk in that game.
Okay, so that almost makes sense until the final shot then, because he goes, like, he doesn't have a shot, and then he makes, like, the sailor makes a trick shot and gets, like, the 3-ball in the corner pocket, and it's like, well, if he could just, like, shoot any ball in any pocket, why was he aiming specifically for that ball? I don't know. It doesn't necessarily make the scene any less awesome, because it's just great filmmaking.
Just weird, because, like, the tension's not any higher, because they could just be like, we'll play 8-ball first to win 7 games or whatever, and they could be both tied at 6, and then Sean Penn misses a shot, the sailor sinks it to win. It just, it's sort of weird, but whatever the game is, whatever rules they're playing by, it's really entertaining, it's really exciting, in sort of classic storytelling. The sailor goes up early, Sean Penn comes back, the sailor gets up, Sean Penn catches up again, and then misses a shot that sort of, or doesn't have a shot, and then the sailor wins.
Yeah, I got kind of a Rounders vibe out of this scene, you know, I almost felt like Nick Cage was Worm, and he was, like, setting up the grift and everything, and, you know, I guess that would make Sean Penn Matt Damon in this situation.
And I guess all the sailors are John Malkovich?
Well, they would be the cops in that scene where they go to the suburbs to play that game and get caught.
Oh, sure, okay.
And get
yeah.
beat, I guess, you know? But it's like the same, like you said, it's like classic grifting, Hustle 101. But I don't know, I love the escalation. It was great because you know if they lose, they're going to get their asses kicked because there's four sailors, like each of them twice the size of them, and they're pissed.
I'm watching the pool scene right now, and when they rack them up, I guess they're just missing a ball on the table, which is just weird. Or maybe this is the rules of the game we just don't understand. But when they rack them up, they just have 14 out of 15 in the triangle.
Okay.
So that's why it's 14. So basically, you know, when you go up 14-0, that means that he sunk all the balls without giving Sean Penn a chance to shoot.
Okay, that I get it now.
So the sailor wins, and Nick Cage's like, all right, here's your money. I got to get going. And Sarah's like, you don't mind if we count it, do you? He's like, oh, sure, go ahead and count. I'm just going to get going. And they stop him, and there's like $12 and then just all counterfeit money. Like,
it's
obviously
like Monopoly money.
Their genius plan to sneak out the fire exit backfires because the fire exit is locked, which seems like it's a safety hazard, first of all.
Yeah, I wonder if one of the sailors like locked it in the middle of the game when no one was looking, because they knew that regardless, these guys were going to beat their ass.
That, I guess, is the only thing that makes sense.
I'm stretching. I am stretching. Because you don't lock a fire exit. Because Nick Cage is like, don't worry, there's a fire exit. We're going to get home clearing. You know, we'll be out in no time.
So the sailors win. They grab Cage and Penn, and they're about to attack them. But they both like swing a pool cue and somehow get past all four, get outside, barricade the door with the pool cues, get in their car, in a bit of made-for-the-movies tension, the car doesn't start, and then they eventually get away.
And it's Sean Penn's character. It's his birthday, we find out. Like, I just love the way information is revealed in this movie. Like, they get home from losing the pool game, and they're all depressed and everything, and his dad's like, where you been? Your mother's been waiting for you. It's your birthday. Gosh, gee, crazy kids. I'm like, it's his birthday. Like, that is great. You know, that's just wonderful detail.
But that proves, like, just sort of how good a guy Sean Penn is, that, like, on his birthday, he's willing to risk getting his ass kicked by four sailors just to help his friend get out of a bind.
Yeah, good point.
That's why Sean Penn is just genuinely a good guy in this movie. So after the pool game, they fail to get the money. They go back to Sean Penn's house. His dad yells at them about not being there on his birthday. And Caddy's there. And they're like, hey, we needed money. You know, Nick Cage is in a bind. We need $150. So Nick Cage says to her, hey, you're rich. Just give me the money.
Yeah. And then she and Henry, she's like, what's going on, Henry? Why do you need the money? And he's like, you know, Sally needs an abortion. We tried. You know, I didn't want to ask. You know, I don't care if you're rich or not, but we need the money. So then she goes to the house she lives, and she tries to steal the pearls from the girl who lives there and gets caught. But the girl doesn't even know she's stealing them. She's like, oh, let's try them on. And then Caddy just like breaks down crying, and it was like such a good kid. She's like, I was going to steal these because I need money for an abortion. Not my abortion. Well, she doesn't say what she needs the money for, but she does eventually get the money for them, even though she's not rich.
Yeah, doesn't like the girl that she's about to steal the pearls from is basically just like, hey, like, I'll help you. Like, doesn't she gets the money from her, right?
Yeah, she gets the money from her. She's like, I'll pay it back. And we don't know if she ever does. But the girl there is just like, yeah, no problem. Like, I got you covered.
Do you see the house I live in? Like, yeah, I can give you $150.
Yeah, really? All you need to do is ask.
And so the four of them, Nick Cage and his pregnant girlfriend, Sean Penn, and Elizabeth McGovern, all go to the abortion trailer in the woods. And they walk her to the door, and Nick Cage is like, well, bye. That sort of makes everybody angry.
Yeah, Nick Cage doesn't even get out of the car to walk his girlfriend to the door. Like, Caddy gets out, and then Sean Penn is like, I should probably get out too. And then he is insensitive.
I remember later in the movie, Sean Penn's like, man, you didn't even hold the door for her.
Oh, I think when they dropped her off, she, like, when they drop her off at home, she, like, opens her own door to the car and, like, gets out and, like, walks to her own front door, and it's, like,
and
all
like,
very sad.
And she's, like, way disoriented. Like, she just had an abortion. She, like, she probably shouldn't be, like, walking. She should be, like, you know, rolled around in a wheelchair. And then instead, he's just, like, basically sitting in the car drinking, driving around. Like, it's such a big deal for him. Like, he didn't have to pay for the $150. He didn't have the abortion, and like he's acting like it's the worst thing in the world that's ever happened to him.
Yeah, and Sean Penn like calls him out on it too, you know? He's like, you think you're having a bad day, you know? What about Sally?
So then Caddy basically just says, enough's enough, pull over, I want to get out. She gets out, and she's just disgusted, and I think she's sort of mad. She sort of has like displaced anger towards Sean Penn. I think it's mostly just because he'd be friends with a guy like Nick Cage. It doesn't really, unless I'm missing something, doesn't really make sense why she's sort of mad at Sean Penn.
It seems to be her general frustration with the whole situation. This is right when she's going to tell Sean Penn that she's not, in fact, rich. So her facade is lifted at this point, right? She's got nothing to hide behind anymore. So she just sort of is... I just think that she's just, like, so emotionally wound up that she just explodes, right? Like, it kind of comes from every direction. It's just, like, everything that's been bothering her comes out at once, and she projects it at Sean Penn.
They basically break up. It's not, like, made a big deal about, but, like, it seems like their relationship is over. He's about to ship off to war. Nick Cage thinks, like, he's like, why do you like this girl? You just want, like, a picture of a girl for your wallet? And Sean Penn's basically like, no, like, I love her. Like, this is the girl for me. Like, right before they're about to ship out, she's like, I'm done with you. I'm done with it. I'm moving on. And so then Sean Penn goes and talks to his dad. He talks to Nick Cage. And then he hatches, just like Nick Cage won back Valley Girl in Valley Girl, Sean Penn has, like, an adorable plan to get this girl back.
Yes, the map.
He goes to her door and leaves her a letter with a treasure map to the place where they first made out, first had sex. She follows the map, and she finds a present, and she opens the present, and it's a pair of shoes that she had wanted earlier when she and Sean Penn were sort of on a date. That was sort of, I guess, his first inkling that she wasn't rich. Because he's like, oh, they were just $25, why wouldn't you buy them? And she's like, well, why would I?
Yeah, she says, we can't buy everything we want. And that's a good line, because it doesn't say that she's not rich, you know, but it gives him an idea of the way she thinks, like her philosophy of life, you know, like he now sees her as not someone who would just buy anything she wanted just to make someone or something, you know, or herself happy.
And there's a lot of information in this movie that certain characters know, and certain characters know about other characters, and certain characters know that those other characters know. And it's never really clear who knows she's rich, who thinks she's rich. When she goes to buy the shoes, she says, you know, you can't always buy what you want. I think that sort of shakes up Sean Penn's worldview a little bit. Because at that point, she doesn't know, I don't think, that Sean Penn thinks she's rich, right?
Well, no, he thinks she's rich.
But does she know that he thinks she's rich?
Oh, that is a good, that's a good point. I'm not sure when she, listen to how we're talking, I'm not sure when she knows that he knows that she's rich.
And that's sort of, and like when she finally finds out, I don't think she knows at that point, because when she finally realizes that he thinks she's a Gatsby, she gets really upset.
Oh yeah, her friend kind of tells her, right? The one that she tries, she's like, oh, he thinks you're rich, and she's like, huh.
But her friend's like, you know, why do you even care? Like, you don't love him, do you? And she's just like, well,
maybe.
And so after she finds the treasure map, after she gets the shoes, they make up, and it's the last scene of the movie. The train is leaving to go off to war.
I have some problems with this ending. We'll get to there when we get to the very end of it. But what did you think of Nick Cage's outfit? Did you notice it?
I mean, he's wearing like a weird white sweater sort of thing.
And he's got like a white and red bow tie.
It's very strange.
What is like something his character, like it almost feels like we're supposed to feel like he, I don't know, like he was all dressed in white. He was getting on that train. I think he's going off to die. You know, I think it's like he's a, you know, he's going to be a ghost, like, from now on. I don't know. That's why I sort of had an issue with the end of it, because the train takes off. Well, Caddy gives Henry the picture for his wallet.
Yep. Yep.
Which is hilarious. That was a great payoff. I smiled and chuckled at that moment. And then, like, the train goes, and Nick Cage and Sean Penn, they race.
They just don't get
they
on.
They just don't get on. They just, like, stand there and, like, start smiling at each other. Like,
and everybody's freaking out.
The dad's like, you're missing the train. What is wrong with you?
And it's like they planned it, because they're just like, hey, totally normal. This is how we get on trains.
Yeah, this isn't just the only time we do this. Like, anytime we need to get on a train, we chase after it and jump on the back.
For a second, I almost sort of thought, wait, are they just not going to go to war? Like, I thought that maybe, like, the end of the movie would be like, no, we're just going to stay here. Like, we got what we want now. We're just going to stay here.
That would have been great if the train just pulls out and they're standing there and everyone's looking, like, really confused and the movie just ends.
But instead, they do what they do earlier in the movie. They jump aboard the train. They're headed off to war and the credits roll.
But they're waving and laughing. They're like, bye, we're going off to war, we're gonna die now. And I just, like, I know it's supposed to be an uplifting end because everybody's happy, but I wasn't happy for some reason, because all I could think of is, like, tomorrow they're overseas, you know, in a couple months they're
Cage is in a body bag,
exactly. And, you know, did Sean Penn ever write? And I'm just, you know, all these thoughts are going through my head. Some might be answered in Wind Talkers. I was thinking ahead about Cage at War. Nevertheless, yeah, I don't know. They go for the happy ending, and something in me just wasn't buying it. Even though I like this movie a lot.
Yeah, this is another one of the movies that I almost knew nothing about, and I really liked it. Like, this and Valley Girl, the two that I hadn't seen, really liked both of them, and they're very tonally different. But I really liked both of them, even though, like we said, the ending of this one is sort of weird and funky.
Yeah, I mean, just the tone at the end, for me. I'm sure everybody has their own opinion about the ending, and that's fine. But otherwise, I was very impressed with this movie. You know, very solid writing. These kids were great actors. You know, Cage brought it, Sean Penn. Like, it makes sense that I enjoyed it, you know? It's very well crafted. Even this writer, could you believe what the writer has gone on to write?
He basically just wrote Harry Potter for the screen.
Yeah, he wrote all the Harry Potter movies.
Which is crazy.
You know, stuck to his sensibilities, right? You know, he's good with kids and writing kid problems or kids dealing with big problems.
So that pretty much does it for this episode of Cage Club, the podcast. Next up, we have the Cotton Club, which is... I don't know anything about it, and I sort of like not knowing anything about these movies. Like, all I know is that Nick Cage is in it to some extent, and we're there for the ride. But it's a Richard Gere movie set in the jazz era? I'm not sure. Is it like in the 1920s? Do you know?
Yeah.
Have you seen The Cotton Club?
I have seen it once. It takes place at the legendary Cotton Club, I believe, the one in Harlem in the 1920s. Okay. So it's sort of based on actual hearsay.
Okay.
It was like the Studio 54 of its time, I guess. You know, it's just like all the legendary jazz acts were coming out of that.
Gotcha. I really like period piece Nicolas Cage. We got him in the 40s, and well, really, in the last one, in Rumblefish, he's sort of... It could be 80s, but we sort of have him like 1960s maybe Cage.
Yeah.
Now we have 40s Cage. Next up is 1920s Cage.
Amazing. Cage in every decade would be so great by the end of this entire endeavor. Would not be happier if that happened.
He's just nailing it. He's just on point. If you like what you heard today, if you just found this somehow, check out our blog. It's cageclub.me. We write reviews for 3 movies a week. We put up podcasts 3 times a week. Podcast is on iTunes. Podcast is also hosted on our site. You can follow me on Twitter at SoulPopped. And you can follow Mike on Twitter at TheMikester. And both of those Twitter links are in the sidebar on our homepage of Cage Club. So if you want to follow us, if you want to let us know how you think we're doing, go ahead and feel free.
Yeah, and if you did find us on iTunes, take the time to give us a rating, because apparently that helps, I heard, from listening to other podcasts. You want to go and rate us, positive or negative, but hopefully positive.
So, I mean, I guess the ultimate goal, the ultimate dream of this would be to meet Nicolas Cage. We don't think that's going to happen, but if it somehow did, it would be the best thing ever.
Yes, entirely agree. You know, this is already worth it for me, and I look forward to continuing the show, but, I mean, that would just be like... a wish granted from a genie somewhere that we would have met and, you know, possibly interview Nicolas Cage.
And it all begins with you rating and reviewing us on iTunes. So for Mike Manzi, I'm Joey Lewandowski. This was episode 5 of Cage Club, Racing with the Moon. If you want to watch the movie, if you like the way it sounded, it is available for streaming on Netflix. So it's one of those ones, a lot of his early stuff isn't available out there for free. You sort of have to pay for it. But this one, you can catch for free, so that's pretty cool.
I suppose that'll do it for today.
All right, see you next time.
Tangerine, she is all they claim. With her eyes of night and lips as bright as flame. Tangerine, when she dances by, Senorita stare and Caballero sigh. And I've seen times when Tangerine had the bourgeoisie believing she were queen. Yes, she's had them all on the run, but her heart belongs to just one. Her heart belongs to Tangerine.
when the heat's on, there's nobody can lay down a set of pins faster than me. I'm the best you got.
No, you're not.
Oh. Well, then, you got me, boss.